Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, and rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to look at an experimental study in the United States using transcranial magnetic stimulation to treat addicts. We'll speak to Dr. Vaughan Steele, who's over there. He's midway through this experimental study where we really have no idea whether or not it will actually help addicts and hasn't really been tested before. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at @newstalkscience. We get to all of those at the end of the program. First up, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen of UCD and science writer Dr. Claire O'Connell. Our first story, Claire, has to do with snails.
It does. It does. This is a fascinating, if slightly grotesque, study. And if your listeners are in any way squeamish about snails and eyes, it is maybe time to put down the sandwich now for a couple of minutes. Because this research, which was published in Nature Communications, tells us about the apple snail, which is a powerful creature that can actually regrow its own eyes entirely if it needs to. Now, this seems to us like a really good trick because as humans, we can't do that. We can't regrow big parts of ourselves. But scientists are very interested in animals that can. And there are a lot of them. You know, there are worms, there are other snails, there are jellyfish, there are zebrafish, there are, you know, loads of them in the animal kingdom that can regrow bits of themselves. But this particular snail can regrow its eyes entirely. And its eyes are quite complex. So like us, they have a lens, they have a cornea, they have a retina, they have an optic nerve. And basically, this snail, it's very well known around the world as an invasive pest, actually. It comes originally, it's a freshwater snail from South America, but it's well known for devastating crops worldwide when it gets into them, you know, particularly rice crops. But scientists in the United States discovered that it also has this really neat trick. And basically what they did was they showed that it can regrow its eyes entirely within about 3 months. Now, it gets a lot of the job done in about a month and then kind of fine tunes it over the next while. Whether or not they can see through these eyes is something they haven't published about yet.
Oh.
But they regrow all the structures of the eyes, which is really interesting. And what they did was they used kind of gene editing techniques to look at various genes that might be involved in eye development. And they showed that, yes, there's one gene in particular, PAX6, which is a very well-known developmental gene. So they were able to change this in the snails and they showed, yes, it is involved in eye development, etc. So basically, what's kind of come out of this paper is that this apple snail could be a really, really good model for studying eye development and regeneration.
No, sorry, we're not having that. You're telling me that these scientists went and had a look at these snails and they published a paper before they just put one hand over the eye of the snail and got to see whether or not it could see a chart.
Can you still see the telly? Yeah, no.
Like, that is ridiculous. Why did they not test the sight of the snail? And obviously there's ways of doing it. It's not an eye chart thing, but they could do that by, you know, putting treats in front of them or something, right? Why would they not? I mean, why would you bother publishing this saying, oh, they can regrow their eyes? Yeah, we don't know if they work yet. I mean, like, why would you not finish? It's just to tap it in. It's a tap in.
They can regrow the structures of the eyes, which is really, really impressive. And the thing about the snails is that they're...
Not if you can't see out of them, Claire.
Well, they could be working.
What use is it of regrowing an eye that doesn't work? I mean, that's just ridiculous.
They could be working on them now. They're saying that this snail is a good model because you can use it. It's easy to grow in the lab. It has lots of babies. It has a short regeneration time. If you can get a permit to grow it because it's an invasive species and it loves to eat lettuce. So that's what they're saying about the apple snail. Now, I was kind of thinking, like, is it useful to know what a snail's eye does and how it regenerates? So I did ask my go-to person in this regard, who is Professor Brendan Kennedy in University College Dublin. Brendan works on zebrafish eyes, actually, at UCD Conway Institute. And he was telling me that it is very important, actually, for scientists to be looking at various different models of eye development.
But is there anything we can learn from these snails that we might actually grow our own eyes? Because if not...
Yeah, that would be a long way down the road, I'd imagine. Like snail, it would take us a while to get there, you know.
we've learned something. Our second story, Shane, has to do with CERN.
Yeah, I'm feeling nervous now after that grilling you gave, Claire. Fortunately, there were no snails in my story, but I'd like to stand up for those snails. They deserve to see, so good for those scientists. My story's about building very hardy electronics for CERN. So CERN, of course, is the organization that is responsible for the Large Hadron Collider, massive particle accelerator under France and Switzerland, where the Higgs boson was discovered. And so what the Large Hadron Collider does is it smashes protons, accelerated protons, into one another, and it makes all sorts of wacky and weird particles that teach us about the fundamentals of the universe. But it's really tricky from an engineering point of view to make those observations, in particular in the so-called ATLAS detector, which is the big, huge one that's there. They use a large...
This is the ring that collects the debris from the smashes. So the protons hit each other and they smash them again. And it sort of captures this splatter pattern.
Exactly.
Of these two protons.
That's a lovely way of putting it, a splatter pattern. I called it a cascade. So when the newly created particle is detected, what happens is it goes into a tank of cold argon. And it then kind of cascades. It causes a kind of this weird pattern. These are always the pictures we see when we see publications of CERN that mean nothing to anyone except a particle physicist. But it's determining how to turn that signal into a digital like one or zero, so you can count it. That's the tricky part. That's where the engineers have to step in. And they've been doing all sorts of incredible things to get around the damaging radiation that happens at a very localized level within the Large Hadron Collider. So ordinary circuits would just be completely fried by the extreme environment. And you'd have particles going left, right, and center, turning ones into zeros and vice versa, giving you all sorts of false readings. It would also like melt your circuitry, causing short circuits. Effectively, it would mean that you can't rely on your detector, so you wouldn't know if it's right or not. And that's where this story gets interesting. Engineers in Columbia University have recently built a very robust form of circuitry that will be able to like keep the ATLAS detector and its light going and improve its accuracy, so that when it goes on to discover the next big thing at a physics level, it'll be built on a very strong foundation of solid engineering.
I was going to ask you a follow-up question on this, but it does get very dense, doesn't it? And I suppose for our audience, kind of understanding how difficult it is to get data from this extraordinary experiment and the sensitivity of the equipment to radiation and so on, it kind of feels like that's as deep as we can go. Am I underestimating the audience, or is there more to this, Shane?
Well, I don't think you're, I think that the audience would appreciate that when you're working in extreme environments, you need extreme engineering. I often think when we talk about the likes of the Large Hadron Collider, we focus on the physicists or maybe the mathematicians, but we forget that just like all the big space missions, it's only possible because there are amazing engineers that do equally brilliant work to build the thing. Yeah. And like without them, the physicists just wouldn't be able to do their thing. And they all work together. And unlike the Big Bang Theory, I'm a big proponent of everyone just does their bit, do the bit that you like and do it well.
Well said, Shane. Well said. OK, our third story, Claire, has to do with making more sustainable chocolate.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, sure, we all love chocolate. Who doesn't love chocolate? Well, I suppose maybe the environment doesn't love chocolate because farming cocoa, which is one of the main ingredients of chocolate, can take a pretty hefty toll on the environment. And this new study, which is led by the University of Queensland in Australia, focused on cocoa farming in West Africa, and particularly in Ghana and Ivory Coast, because between them, these two countries produce around 60% of the world's cocoa. We're quite reliant on it, but it also, that cocoa farming brings, it can bring a lot of damage in terms of cutting down existing forests to clear them for cocoa plantations, And cutting down forests is seldom a good idea when it comes to the environment. And also this monoculture can produce a lot of carbon. You know, there's very high carbon emissions, which again is a huge problem. So one way you can mitigate against this is to plant shade trees. So this is a form of agroforestry, agro meaning like agricultural as opposed to agro meaning.
Oh, I thought when you said like these are shade trees and this is part of agroforestry, I was like, I thought I was getting very excited. I thought that these would be some sort of some rude trees, but no.
Yeah, okay. There you go. Agro trees throwing shade. But by throwing shade, they can help protect the cocoa plants. They can buffer temperatures and stuff like that. They also provide more biodiversity just by dint of being there, and also they support, you know, things like other insects and birds and things like that, and they can take in carbon from the atmosphere. So that's the idea behind them, and that's this kind of planting of shade trees is done in cocoa plantations around the world. But of course, if you plant too many trees, then you get a kind of a reduction of the cocoa crop because, you know, there's obviously, you know, limited resources in the one area, etc. So you kind of have to get the balance right. And it seems that if you plant about 30 to 50% shade trees in these cocoa planted areas, that seems to be about the optimal. That seems to be the sweet spot for the biology, for the ecosystem. So what they did in this study of Queensland was they generated maps of the cocoa planted areas in these two countries, in Ghana and Ivory Coast. And they used satellite images from the European Space Agency's Sentinel-2 satellite. And they used things like maps of tree canopy height, and they did kind of field measurements as well. And then they used machine learning to generate this map of the forest cover and the biomass. Mm. And what they found was that it, at the moment, it falls well short of the 30%. So it's around 13%, 1-3. But that if they got it up to the 30%, it could offset a huge amount of carbon. It could offset about 167% of the current cocoa-related emissions of these two countries. And in practical terms, that would mean sequestering up to 10.2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent each year over the coming decades. So now, obviously, planting trees, you kind of have to wait for them to grow, etc. And there are already tens of millions of trees planted here for, you know, with this purpose. So the researchers are definitely saying, look, you have to put the focus on protecting the forests that are already there, but that this agroforestry could offer a way for more kind of sustainable farming in the long term, which I thought was kind of interesting. So it might take a kind of another level of guilt out of eating chocolate if it works, maybe.
Yeah. It's mad, isn't it? Climate change is such an all-encompassing problem. But, you know, from speaking to researchers at Chagas and hearing, you know, these lots of different ways that people are addressing, you know, climate change, there's lots of niche little things that have surprising gains that can make an impact. You know, growing tall trees in cocoa forests is not something I'd ever thought I'd ever hear about. Shane, our final story has to do with birds.
Yes, and about their marital behavior or not. So some birds are monogamous and some are not. And it's not entirely clear why certain species go down one road over the other. And for the last 75 years, the good people at the Wytham Tit Project have been understanding the behavior of great tits in this regard. And they've just published an amazing piece of work that followed quite literally a couple of thousand, so 1,169 breeding pairs over three mating seasons.
Wow.
And they were able to use RFID tags, that's radio frequency identification tags, that are attached to the birds in a way that doesn't harm them. And they were looking at how they relate to one another. In other words, do they follow each other around? How close are they to one another? How do they socialize with other birds? And what they were looking at here, and by the way, great tits tend to be monogamous. So they stay with a partner for the entire breeding season. And then they can decide whether they want to move on to pastures new or stick with somebody that they know and love. And so what they found here was that they could see certain kind of clues that predicted the likelihood of the birds splitting up after the season. And just like people, right, they're kind of, you could probably guess what some of these findings are. The first one is the couples. Snort, yes, exactly. Yeah, taking all the duvet. Now, another one is avoidance. So if they start to avoid one another, in other words, if one arrives, the other leaves, that is a predictor that they're going to split up. no surprises there. Another one is this idea of bonding. If they kind of, you know, spend time with each other and they really pay attention to one another and they look after each other in terms of like grooming and whatnot, that degree of faithfulness is a predictor of sticking together. And it goes on like this, but the findings are
isn't that really the definition of sticking together?
It is, but it's that these are predictive, so they're happening in advance of the point at which we would have previously seen them just go their own way or not. And so what they're wondering now from this story is, it's a very rare insight into the social dynamics of another species, and it shows how relationships are formed, how they might persist, and how they break down. Now, crucially, I should stress that the scientists are not looking to interfere with the behavior of the birds. There's no right or wrong way to do this from an animal point of view. Species that tend to be monogamous do it for very understandable reasons. It's shared resources. It's kind of putting all your eggs in one basket, as it were. But similarly, having lots of partners increases the likelihood of breeding successfully with somebody. So there's, from an animal point of view, without wishing to add any morality into this, there's a lot of sense in choosing each path. But Jonathan, this isn't the only bird story that was published this week. I have to tell you about dancing cockatoos. This is a bit of a sensation on social media. We often see videos of birds dancing along with people who play music at home. And scientists in Australia looked at 45 videos from social media. They identified 30 distinct moves from the cockatoo. 17 of them were never seen by scientists before.
Because they never go to nightclubs, Shane.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe this could have been your whole area of interest. But they looked at Wagga Wagga Zoo natives, 6 cockatoos. They studied them for 9 days. They gave them a podcast. They gave them a dance anthem, which probably you know it, I don't. And then they gave them silence, which would be my preference. And it found that there was no effect. So they don't actually dance along with music. They just seem to dance along in general. And this only happens for cockatoos in captivity. It's known that birds dance to attract a mate. We don't know why they do it on their own in captivity. It's thought that they're just bored. So, there you go. Dancing cockatoos.
So cockatoos, all those videos on the internet actually just show a bird just being bored rather than a bird dancing to the music that they think they are. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and the wonderful Dr. Claire O'Connell, science writer, thank you so much for joining us. Now, addiction by its nature is a tricky thing. Psychological supports and therapy can yield great results. But what if you could just rewire the brain to not be addicted? This summer, deep in a Connecticut treatment center, one neuroscientist is trying to do just that, not with drugs or anything else, but with electromagnetic pulses. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, and it's already proven itself in the treatment of depression and sometimes in smoking. But could it be a game changer for those battling alcohol and opioid addiction? Well, Dr. Vaughan R. Steele is an associate professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine. He joins us now. Welcome to the program, Vaughan. Before we get into TMS and what it might be able to do for us, maybe you might talk to us about what's going on in the brain when we're addicted and what the focus point is when we're trying to treat addiction.
Oh, of course. Yes. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here to chat about the Summer of TMS project and TMS in general. I think addiction is, the way we think about it now, is that it's sort of a dysregulation of circuits. We all have paths in the brain or circuits that drive different behaviors, and they get somewhat dysregulated when you have an addicted behavior. In this case, we're talking about alcohol or opioid use disorder. And the way I look at it, that there's sort of this push-pull in the brain, this drive to go use something, and then this sort of top-down control to stop using it. I think of it as the gas pedal and the brake. So this gets dysregulated in a way that there's too much drive to use or not enough brake to stop from using. And that can be applied in several different substances of abuse. And so TMS in general is applied the way I'm doing it, and others also, trying to modulate one or both of these circuits in a way that will change behavior long-term and get these circuits back into regulation.
So when we talk about wiring and circuits, obviously these are analogies that we use from electronics, we're talking about neurons and electrical, I suppose, pathways of neurons speaking to each other within the brain, right?
Exactly.
This is a very complex network of communication that we're talking about. How does TMS work?
Oh, very good question. And the short answer is we don't exactly know. The hope, though, is that if we're with different types of TMS, when we place it on and target a specific circuit or connection, we can, with different stimulation, either inhibit that or turn it down, or excite that and turn it up. So we can either strengthen a connection or weaken a connection, with then hopefully that has this knock-on effect of changing behavior downstream. Some of my other work is using magnetic resonance imaging to better understand the circuitry and how it's changing with TMS.
Right.
That's a different project, but because we don't really know how it works and how to apply it the most effectively, I can't really answer what is it doing and how does it do what it does, right?
Well, we've been using anesthetic for many decades. We don't fully understand how it works, but it works.
Indeed.
The jury is still out, I suppose, on TMS. So maybe to clarify for people who have not heard of TMS, what exactly is it that you're doing?
Oh, sure. So there are several types of TMS. The one that I use, we have sort of a small focal coil to try to hit a very small part of your brain. It's about the size of the diameter of like a ping pong ball, what we're targeting in the brain. And we have copper wires wound up into a coil shape, the figure of eight coil shape. We pass electric current through that, rapidly turning it on and off, generates a magnetic pulse, electric magnetic pulse, that generates an electric current. All the cells in your body run on electric current. And by stimulating with a single pulse, we can pass that current through and stimulate the neurons in your brain, which then have them fire and then have this knock-on downstream effect of strengthening or weakening the circuit with different repetitive stimulation types.
So you said you're trying to target an area of the brain that's about the size of a ping pong ball.
Yes.
That's a lot of brain cells. And I'm guessing, you know, that within that clump of gray matter, there's a lot of different functions and a lot of different cells that do a lot of different things. Is that precise enough for us to direct an electric current to? Why are we using something like this? And could we not be more precise, or is there not a need to be more precise?
There's a trade-off with precision. There are a couple types of TMS, and the ping pong ball might be a little bit larger than we're targeting, but it's a good visual, right? But it is quite focal, and you're right. We're stimulating all the neurons in that area, right? Excitatory, inhibitory neurons, and other structures that are in there. So that's why we can't really say what it's doing and why it's working to stimulate things downstream. The other types of TMS are sort of broad, and they hit much larger, like almost the whole front of the head with a broader stimulation type. So in the field of non-invasive stimulation, we're quite focal. But there are, of course, limitations as far as the number of neurons and specificity of what we're targeting and what it's doing downstream.
Right. So people listening to this might in their head have some sort of electroconvulsive Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest sort of idea. But this is very much not what transcranial magnetic stimulation is about. Tell me, what does it look like? What does it feel like when someone has this electrical current pass through their brain? And how much electricity are we talking about?
Yeah, this is a good point. I think it's important to note that this is one of the things that we talk to participants quite a bit about when we're starting to initiate a research study with them, is that it's not like an electroconvulsive therapy. It's not ECT. We're not inducing a seizure. So the electric current is much lower. I'm not an electrician, so I don't exactly know how much it is, but it's a safe amount. TMS is safe in people who are screened.
I'm hoping you don't say that to patients.
Well,
I'm not sure how much electricity it is, but it's a safe amount.
Yeah, I mean, it's a safe amount. Somebody who's screened and don't have any of the risk factors, there's a very low chance of any kind of major side effect.
Right.
And it's actually fewer side effects than any kind of pharmacological intervention Largely, it's just painful or discomfort underneath the coil that dissipates as soon as you turn the coil off.
Right.
Sometimes there's a headache, but just Tylenol or acetaminophen will take care of it, or it just goes away on its own. Those are the main common side effects. So it's really a non-invasive way of trying to change somebody's brain that then knocks on to change behavior.
I really do want to get into the addiction side of it, but just one last question on that. I mean, you're using a technology that we don't fully understand, and we're messing with the electrical currents within, brain cells. So far, it doesn't seem that this has any negative effect, but do we know enough about it to be using this as an experimental therapy?
I think it's good to be apprehensive and wary of new technologies, for sure. We've been doing TMS for 30 or 40 years now, and it seems like there's not any kind of long-term negative effects. In the fMRI world, they also have similar issues. Like being in a high magnetic field all day seems to not have an issue, but there's lots of concern about it. I think there's enough evidence now that intense interventions, especially in depression, we do this, I don't, but lots of researchers and clinicians do all over the world, that there seems to be enough evidence to say applying TMS, even intense numbers of pulses and interventions, doesn't have a negative effect as long as somebody is screened and it's safe to do it and it's done appropriately with the clinician or a researcher.
Okay. All right. Let's move on from that, because it is fascinating. But actually, what you're talking about here is trying to treat people who are struggling with alcohol use disorder, or opioid use disorder. So you have about 40 participants in this trial. Tell me a little bit about what it is that you're hoping and why you think TMS would be good for this. Is there evidence to suggest that this might be a good treatment for addicts?
Yes, there is. So I've been doing TMS now for about a decade, and all of my work has been building to a project like this. And this one, luckily enough, is funded by Yale Psychiatry, my main department, and then Hartford Hospital and the Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center. And it's sort of culminated in work where I do short sessions to show malleability of circuits. And then I did a intervention trial in cocaine users when I was at National Institute on Drug Abuse. And other people have done similar work, but not in people who are inpatients. So the unique part of this study is that people are very early in recovery. They come and they go through an intensive detox between 4 to 7 days. And then they're in treatment for 14 to 28 days, which is important because the first 3 to 6 months of treatment is when somebody's at greatest risk for relapse. And then especially in opiate use disorder, relapse and then overdose death. Mm. So if you can catch somebody and nudge them a little bit more towards sobriety early in the stage of recovery, is the most vulnerable part would be potentially most effective. So I think a lot of research in the field, stuff I've done and other people, suggest TMS applied in this way or similar ways might be effective, but nobody's done this exact thing yet. So I'm really excited about this opportunity to work with the folks at Rushford and Hartford Hospital to catch people early in treatment.
Yeah, because if this had a very significant effect, it could be a game changer, right? And it's exciting, I'd imagine, as a researcher to be right at the forefront of something like that. What about the patients themselves? What do they think about this idea? And obviously they've got to go through ethical review and they've got to agree to take part. How do they feel about using TMS? And what have they said to you? Have you managed to speak to any of them?
Oh yes, of course. I'm running the TMS coil for all these participants. So I've talked to every one of them and gone through every session with them. I think the appropriate level of apprehension and concern and a little bit of anxiety when they start, just because, as I described to them, like you asked me earlier, what does it feel like? I can't tell you exactly what it feels like because everybody responds differently and they tell me how it feels different to them. Mm. Some people say it's actually quite painful. Some people say it's almost no pain and just some discomfort. And so it's hard to describe it. So once they get through the first session, their anxiety comes down. They are fine with it generally. So it's infrequent for somebody to not want to continue because they're in treatment already. They've made a decision to change their life. Mm. They've decided the path they're on isn't working for them. And they see TMS as an experimental intervention that might help them get better. So they are on board to get better. And if they see something new that might help them, and they've seen some of their friends in the treatment center already go through it, and then they vouch for us as nice people and TMS isn't that bad, then they're willing to try it.
Right. So the patients who are addicted currently or recovering from addiction, can you see changes in activity in the brain with fMRI? Like if you were an expert in this, would you be able to see an addicted brain versus a non-addicted brain behave differently with fMRI? Is it possible you could do any sort of measurement before and after to see whether or not activity, communication in the brain had changed, or is this sort of a suck it and see sort of intervention?
I'm really glad you asked me that question because I've done most of my work in brain imaging, and this summer of TMS can't do imaging because the scanner's not at the clinic. But yes, largely with certain tasks, a craving task and executive control task, these would be measuring the gas pedal and the brake that I talked about earlier. Mm. You absolutely can see differences between the addicted brain and a control brain that's not addicted. And then that is how we better understand which parts of the brain we should target with TMS and try to change.
Right. Okay. So you can actually see this part of the brain would be a good target for
yep.
it. And that's why you've chosen this this area of the brain
yeah,
to target.
That's part of the reason why I started targeting the areas that I am, because I've done studies like this already. I just finished a larger study last year where we had 30 people where I affectionately call them cupcake days, where we get the brain measure of craving, executive control, and then we do TMS, and then we do those same brain measures again in the scanner. So we sort of if you think about a cupcake and there's a frosting on top, you think about the frosting as TMS. The way I eat the cupcake, I brought this into lab once as a celebration. You rip the bottom off and you make a sandwich out of it. And so then after that, we called them cupcake days. The field likes to call them sandwich days, but cupcake days is fun in the lab. But the idea is exactly what you're saying, is that you can measure an acute change in the brain function based on TMS. And in fact, I have data that I'm working up now that does suggest I can modulate both the executive control network and craving in opiate users in these cupcake days that I'm working on publishing. So it seems quite promising.
How effective do you think the treatment is so far? Is it hard to tell?
It's hard to tell because the primary long-term outcome will be use. So once they're discharged from the treatment center, we will call them up to 3 months later and to assess what they've been up to. Have they been using or not? And we have just a handful of people that have been out a month or so. So we've got a couple months still to follow up. Our last TMS day is August 15th. So then 3 months from there, we'll have better understanding of what people have done. And the hope is that people who get TMS relapse later and less often than people who didn't get TMS, because we're recruiting some people who don't do the TMS part because there isn't time.
Yeah.
But we do have some initial craving measures. So we ask them, how much do you crave? How much do you want to use right now? How likely are you to quit in the future? Could you resist? Things like that. And those numbers are going in the right direction. They're craving less after TMS. They think they can resist more. They think they have a higher likelihood of quitting after TMS. And the controls either have no change or they increase a little bit in a negative way. So in that first blush of, we just looked at like 10 or 15 people, it looks like in the short term, while they're in treatment, TMS does a little bit better job of their ability to reduce craving and increase their desire to use, or decrease their desire to use, increase their resistance.
In terms of animal models, we have animal models for addiction, right? Have we done TMS on animals? Has it shown to be effective?
So the short answer is Sort of. Remember, we go back to the TMS types that I was talking about. The one we use stimulates about ping pong ball size of the brain.
Yeah.
If you applied that to a rat, which is one of the bigger animal models, not many people have done this in monkeys, but rats or mice, that's the entire brain. So you have no specificity of a rat brain with TMS to get specific targets. Now, you could do like deep brain stimulation or more focal stimulations like that. I do know also they're developing smaller coils. So that would be most effective in rats and mice to get the smaller circuits. So there's some evidence, maybe it will work. They do actually, instead of doing TMS in these animals, they do what's called optogenetic stimulation, which they, I'm not a preclinical guy, but they inject basically something that binds the specific circuits. And then if they shine a light through an electrode, it will stimulate specific neurons in an area. So it's very focal stimulation. And so that I've used a lot to sort of motivate specific circuits in the brain that are very similar between preclinical and clinical models to suggest TMS could be effective in modulating a specific circuit. So there's not a one-to-one between the two, but it's similar enough to make strong arguments that say TMS could be effective in addiction.
Well, the best of luck to you in the rest of the trial, but most importantly, the best of luck to all of your patients, whether they got TMS or not. I hope they managed to make a full recovery. It's wonderful to speak with you. Really interesting study. Dr. Vaughan Steele from Yale School of Medicine. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Just to get to your comments from last week, we had Holly Cunningham asking, could colour be the answer to reviving marine life? Connor dropped us an email. He said, hi, Future Brief. I've come across a few articles recently about the loss of colour in our designed environment. I think it might be an interesting topic to cover on the programme. I've just been on holiday, and it's actually a feature of the designed environment in so many countries. Much more so than it is here, to bring color, particularly in areas of that are underdeveloped or poorer areas. For example, La Boca in Buenos Aires, the La Boca area is really, really beautiful. It's right by the harbor, and the locals wanted to, you know, to make their town or their part of the town a little bit more appealing. So they basically got spare paint from the ships that came in, and that's why La Boca is all this mix of really bright colors. Ireland is actually quite a grey country when you think about architecture and how we've designed our country in terms of the buildings that we make. We could absolutely do with a lot more colour. So it's definitely something we'll look into. Thanks very much for that, Connor. That's it from us on this week's episode, though. Marisa O'Sullivan was producing. Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva round out the team. Thank you so much to them. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.